Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Athletic Support, your favorite and only podcast on Montreal Canadiens. I am Marc-Antoine Gagnon, and on this Friday, March 19th, I am, as usual, accompanied by Arpin Basu. Arpin, how are you doing, my friend?
Good, man. Good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Friday.
Yeah.
Friday. Got back-to-back with the Canucks coming up. Canadiens are back home. Going to be in the Bell Center. It's going to be fun. So yeah, I'm pumped.
Joel Edmondson said that he felt as though they were gone for a month. So it's good that they're back home. Let's see if they'll score as many goals against the Canucks as they've done so far this season. But first of all, I want to mention to all our listeners that our guest today will be none other than super agent Alan Walsh from Octagon Hockey. He represents, among other people, Jonathan Drouin. So he'll be the guest on our show later on. We're going to discuss the trade deadline, who's coming up faster than usual. The performances also of the Canadiens in overtime. It's been a big topic of discussion this week. And actually, since the beginning of the season, because the Canadiens have just plainly sucked at it, let's face it. The Heritage Minute also. But first of all, Arpin, trade deadline. Why is it already a topic when we're almost a month away from trade deadline? Trade deadline's on April 12th, so we're less than a month away from it. But it has picked up steam a lot sooner than it usually does.
Well, I mean, in Canada, the reason's obvious because, you know, the Canadian teams need to deal with that two-week quarantine if they're dealing with American teams. So that creates a sense of urgency. The standings are so tight in the North Division. But really, throughout the NHL, I mean, if you look at all the other divisions, you know, the space between first and fourth in every division, except the Central, is pretty crazily tight, you know. And so, what one team does more than in a normal season, I think what one team does in a given division is going to resonate and is going to impact the direct competitors more than in a normal season. And you know, speaking strictly in the Canadian division, because of that quarantine issue, I think that's why you heard Kyle Dubas this week, earlier this week, just before Marc Bergevin actually spoke, essentially tell the world that he's on the verge of making a trade of some sort. Like, I mean, it was impossible to listen to Kyle Dubas this week and not get the impression that something is very close to being completed. Like, it's the way he was talking was like the Maple Leafs are making a trade. And so when they do, assuming they do, but if you believe Kyle Dubas and the tone he was using, it's imminent in any way, in some ways, it's going to have a ripple effect throughout the division. I don't think it's entirely, like, you know, considering everything that's happened in Montreal, it's pretty crazy to see that they're still within striking distance of Toronto. And you got to remember, you know, they finished the season playing Toronto, I think it's five times in the last 12 games or something. It's or four times. It's really, they have a lot of games against Toronto at the end of the season. It's unlikely they will be able to sweep those. But still, it's four times in the last 2 weeks. So it's, you know, an opportunity could be there once they reach that point in the season to make a huge swing in that gap, if one exists. And so when Toronto does something, does Edmonton react? Edmonton this morning is tied in points with Toronto at 40. They have played three more games than the Maple Leafs. But, you know, Winnipeg is only 2 points back. Montreal's only 6 points back. Which, as I just mentioned, every night being a four-point game, that's not as big of a gap as we're used to seeing in the NHL in the age of parity and everything. There are opportunities for these teams to climb the standings quickly because they have direct competition with their competitors every single night. So, you know, you take Vancouver, for instance. They're playing in Montreal for two games. They're 2 points behind the Canadiens. Canadiens have four games in hand. But still, that's an opportunity for Vancouver to pick up 4 points and for Montreal to pick up none. And that becomes, suddenly they're in a 2-point lead when they leave Montreal, if that happens. And conversely, Montreal has a chance to widen that gap with Vancouver in these two games and kind of get them off their back. So I think that dynamic has created a more competitive trade deadline environment than I think we're used to seeing. And where what one team does is going to have a more direct impact on how another team thinks of itself, because they're going to need to get through that team and they have a better idea of which teams are going to have to beat to get out of the division, as opposed to the conference formula where it's not quite, at this stage of the season, it's not quite clear who you're going to face in the playoffs. So you can't make decisions based on what the Washington Capitals did, for instance, if you're the Canadiens, whereas now you're looking at three teams, basically, maybe four if you include Calgary, where those are clearly the teams that Montreal has to measure itself against. And so if one of them does something, the pressure is on the other three teams to react to that.
What I find interesting is that you mentioned Kyle Dubas. You know, the Toronto Maple Leafs has been battling the salary cap the whole year with LTIR and all sorts of maneuvers to try to give themselves some leeway. The Edmonton Oilers have had some LTIR issues. That's how they got their cap space, but they're tight against the cap every bit as much as the Montreal Canadiens, if not more. So you got those two teams that are pretty much in the same cap situation as the Canadiens, but they're certainly open for business. Whereas what we heard from Marc Bergevin this week is a general manager who's a lot more tentative when he looks at his salary cap, and he doesn't seem enthusiastic the least bit at making a move. It doesn't mean that he's not going to do any. I mean, we know Marc Bergevin, every time that his team has been competitive, he pulled the trigger in one way or another, even though sometimes it's been just minor moves. But I have a hard time thinking that he's going to sit on his hands and watch the parade go, especially considering the environment you describe in the division where there's a trickle-down effect from one team to another. If one makes a move, how does the other one react? If Edmonton makes a move, if Toronto makes a move, if the Winnipeg Jets also make a move, I mean, they haven't been afraid. The quarantine has not been an issue for them. Obviously, we've seen that with the Pierre-Luc Dubois trade earlier on. So these teams are all open to make a trade. So very risky to take a conservative approach. It sounds funny that put that way, but I think that Marc Bergevin should think twice before thinking, well, you know what? It's going to be too difficult, too complicated considering our cap situation. We're going to pass. He said we have to be creative to make a move. That's what he said on Tuesday. But honestly, I expect him to be creative. That's his job. And of course, the landscape is the same for every team. And you got to be creative, I understand, but that he's gone so far, you know, so far with the acquisitions, with the coaching changes and whatnot, at this point to say, well, you know what, we're going to stand pat. It's, I don't know. It would be quite underwhelming, I find.
No, I agree. I mean, I think the main thing that Marc Bergevin and really everyone in the division is looking at is that this is a unique opportunity in the sense that, especially if you look at Toronto and Montreal, you know, they have lost. You know, Boston and Tampa are not in their way. It's, and particularly in the case of Toronto, I think that's why Kyle Dubas is talking the way he is because, you know, with no Boston for the Maple Leafs in particular, but still no Tampa in their way on their path. It becomes, at least to get to the conference final, this is a unique opportunity. Gary Bettman has made it clear that we're not going to see this again. You know, assuming that the pandemic gets under control by the time next season begins, and the border is open, that this format will not exist. And so for Kyle Dubas, this is a clear opportunity. Marc Bergevin should look at it in the same way, especially with the offseason he had. And I do want to discuss, you know, your piece yesterday on Canadians trade targets, specifically the Matthias Ekholm situation. You know, with the way Marc Bergevin was talking on Tuesday, it would be easy to surmise that he would be out on this situation, on this Matthias Ekholm thing, considering he is the hottest commodity on the NHL trade market. But really, when you look at the assets the Canadians have at their disposal, they are in a situation where they can make a very competitive offer to the Nashville Predators, perhaps more so than a lot of other teams. And you know, the offer that you outlined in your piece was to do the Jake Muzzin deal where they give up their first round pick, they give up two former second round picks as prospects, in this case Jaden Struble and Luke Tuck. But it could be Jan Mišák, it could be a whole bunch of people. because they have a lot of former second round picks in their stable. Yes, Ulinen, there's lots of candidates there, whichever, you know, David Poile would be interested in. But the added bonus being that they throw the sweetener of Arturi Lehkonen, a player that the Predators could immediately plug into their lineup. He's a useful player. Frankly, if I were the Canadians, I'd be playing him right now, but he's not able to get into the lineup for whatever reason. And he could be used as a piece that puts the Canadiens' offer over the top if Marc Bergevin is A, willing to trade Lehkonen, which is no guarantee, and B, engaged with the Predators in talks on Ekholm, neither of which we can say with any assuredness that he is. But I think the offer that you suggested is a very realistic offer and is one that's going to be very difficult for other teams to beat. And if that opportunity presents itself to the Canadiens, man, Marc Bergevin would be out of his mind not to explore it for a whole number of reasons. The circumstances that I suggested earlier, but also the fact that, let's face it, his contract is going to be evaluated in the summertime because he's going to be entering the final year of his deal. He's made it clear that this season is pivotal for his whole plan and in many ways his own job. And so if that's the case, then go for it, man. Like, I mean, this is, it's not unreasonable and it would not be irresponsible to go after a player who still has 1 year on his contract left at a very, very reasonable number at $3.75 million. Yes. For such a high-end defenseman. It would be irresponsible to not get into the conversation for that player.
Yeah, well, I think that Matthias Ekholm would become the number two defenseman on this team, especially the way Shea Weber has been performing this season, especially lately. I mean, I don't think that he hasn't played as a top two defenseman lately, that's for sure.
No.
And yeah, you mentioned the fact that Ekholm is signed beyond this season, which is huge for the Canadiens. Now, there's a lot of assets. I value my first round picks. He might say, we're about to lose Tatar and Armia. We're going to be short of wingers next season. I need a guy like Lehkonen. He might say, hold on, there's the expansion coming. Who am I going to protect? If I add Ekholm, it means that I have to make both Sherratt and Edmondson available to the Kraken, and I don't want to do that.
Or Weber.
You can find all sorts of explanations. Or Weber. You can find all sorts of explanations to go against that. But if you include, and if you're willing to include a guy like Lehkonen to make the money work, the cap should not be one of those reasons, because anyway, around the league, everybody's talking about making money in, money out deals. It's not only the Canadiens. So I think that if the Predators want to move Ekholm and they want to move it to a contender, most contenders don't have simply the money to add a guy like Ekholm. They wouldn't want to bring, you know, to send a contract out. And as you pointed out, Lehkonen is not a guy with negative value. He's not necessarily a bad contract. He makes $2.4 million a year, which is, for a guy of his caliber, under normal circumstances, a fair ticket. It's not the best value on a salary, but it's not outrageous either. And I think that for the Predators to be able not only to get all the assets that would come from selling a guy like Ekholm, getting your, you know, two prospects, getting your first round pick, but on top of it, you get a roster player that's going to be useful to your team next season, and that's going to contribute to making a little bit of a shift inside your organization. It becomes, I think, very attractive.
It would also be a cap neutral deal. I think it's worth pointing out, in the sense that even if the Predators did not retain any money, which I think under the circumstances they could probably get the Predators to retain a bit of the money, but even if they didn't, at $2.4 million for Lehkonen, plus I think the nuance here that people need to understand is that if you acquire Ekholm, then Xavier Ouellette's number gets removed from the cap. So in essence, you're removing Lehkonen and Ouellette to add Ekholm. So the difference there is pretty minimal.
Like to $300,000.
Yeah, it's less than $500,000. So it's something that the Canadiens could easily do, even if the Predators don't retain any money. And it would be perfectly reasonable for the Canadiens to ask the Predators to retain some money, because I think every team talking to them about Ekholm will be asking them to do that to some extent.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a variety of things that the Canadians can do to improve at the deadline. Even if it's a minor move, the Canadians are showing that as much as they're deep up front, they're not deep at all in defense. I thought that Marc Bergevin's answer regarding Cale Fleury was very lukewarm the other day. He acknowledged that he's still a good prospect for them, but it didn't sound as though Cale Fleury is on the verge of being called up or being considered as a valuable top six defenseman on this team. But Ben Sherratt, who was not playing his best hockey, went down. And all of a sudden, in order to replace him, you have a combination of Victor Mete and Xavier Ouellet, which is, for 6 weeks, far from being an ideal situation. So I think this is the sort of thing that the general manager has to take into account, say, well, if I want to make the playoffs and if I want to bolster my lineup even after Sherratt has come back, I need some improvement on the blue line. So it might not end up being Ekholm. I think that there are some other interesting options that I pointed out in my piece. But this definitely somewhere where they need to look at. And the fourth line, I mean, Paul Byron has not been convincing at all. And he's the only guy on the roster that's been asked to replace Jake Evans at center when Jake Evans was scratched. So those two guys have not been able, I would say, in the last month or month and a half to solve the fourth line duties as the way that both Claude Julien or Dominique Ducharme have expected that guy to do. So this is another position I think that would be interesting to bolster and to improve.
Yeah, I agree. I'm kind of torn on the whole Evans thing because he hasn't been all that effective, but how much do you really need from your fourth line center? I mean, I think the experience Evans is getting is valuable in his development, and I do think that he is a good future fourth line center for this team. So yes, it would be nice to have a more prototypical fourth line center who can win faceoffs, kill penalties, and do all those things. But I think Jake Evans can become that guy. And so I don't think there's the same urgency to address that issue as I feel there is on defense. Because frankly, another area where the lack of depth or the lack of skill on defense shines through has been overtime lately. I know I want to talk about it because, frankly, if the Canadians had gone 500 this season instead of 0-8 in games that go past regulation, they'd be right in the hunt with the Leafs near the top of the division. So it's having a big impact on their season. And, you know, they've gone to overtime 8 times this season. The first time was an opening night in Toronto, and Claude Julien started Shea Weber in the overtime that night. Each of the 7 times since then, Jeff Petrie has started overtime. So I asked him Friday to what extent he agreed with Dominique Ducharme that there's a certain mental aspect to how the Canadiens have been playing in overtime, that they're not sufficiently dealing with the situation well mentally as opposed to an execution aspect. So let's hear what he had to say on Friday.
I think it's got to be a balance. We have a game plan that we want to execute, and we had the one chance to start the overtime, and then I made a poor read calling for the puck back and then got double teamed there, but that's where we have our initial chance, and then that's where we have to kind of take a breath and, whether it's bringing the puck back out or controlling the puck and, where we can get a change and they can't.
So good on Jeff Petrie for kind of acknowledging how he was the source of the mental lapse against the Jets on Wednesday night. He called the mental lapse more so calling for the pass from Dano. And then at that point, getting double teamed and losing the puck and everything. But I thought it was interesting that he thought where he mentally kind of lost it there was calling for the pass from Phil. And because at that point, I think it was too late for him to actually go back with it. What he should have done, as he said, was not call for the pass, have Phil send it back. Tyler Toffoli was already waiting at the blue line for a pass at that point because Paul Byron had gone off. But the greater issue, and I know that Jeff can't speak to this publicly, but really, it strikes me like Dominic Ducharme really seems to be overthinking this whole thing. It's it's not that complicated. Throw your three best players out there, and Jeff Petrie is definitely one of his three best players. So let's be clear that there's nothing wrong with Jeff Petrie starting overtime. But man, I mean, Josh Anderson can't get on the ice in overtime. Tyler Toffoli, who's one of the best goal scorers in the NHL, can't start overtime. Like just get your head around the fact that the opening faceoff is not the end-all be-all. Yes, in an ideal world, you would win it, but Phil Deneau's not winning them. So if that's the case, it's and plus, you know, overtime rarely ends on the first chance anyway. It's not that common. You know, I looked at it for our notebook, which, you know.
Well, it happened for the Canadians a couple of times, though, that they lost.
Well, it did. It could be argued. 40
seconds.
Well, because they lost the faceoff and the guys they had on the ice were not well suited to deal with the situation. I think that's an argument could be made, you know? I mean, it's not as much about the faceoff as it is about the matchup and going best on best. You know, it's really a philosophical thing. And I think Ducharme's strategy is not crazy. He's put a lot of thought into it. And this whole counterattacking and catching them off guard and all this stuff, that's great. But it might be a case of him overthinking. The mental aspect of overtime might apply to Ducharme more than anyone else, more so than his players, because I think he is overthinking it to a certain extent.
Well, when you say three on three overtime is best on best, I agree totally. But isn't it somewhere an acknowledgement that when the best players face off against each other, the Canadians, when it comes to their best players, are not up to par with teams like the Canucks, the Oilers, or the Maple Leafs, or even the Jets for that matter? I mean, if you look at like the top end players of the Canadians, they're on average they're not as good as those teams.
Sure.
And it's most glaring but when you start overtime. So I think that's the source of that counter mentality when you say, well, we're going to rope-a-dope them a little bit.
Well, I mean, I'm just looking at the league's leading goal scorers right now, and the Canadians have the third leading goal scorer in the league right now. That's all I'm saying, yeah. Is that you're right. They're not as good. I mean, first is Austin Matthews, second is Connor McDavid, and third is Tyler Toffoli. No one in their right mind would argue that Tyler Toffoli is in the same conversation as Connor McDavid and Austin Matthews. That would be patently ridiculous. But the fact remains is that you gotta go with your best guys. You gotta go with whatever you have skill wise. It's not gonna, because listen, Phil Deneau is a great defensive forward. Paul Byron's actually a pretty good defensive forward. Those skills don't apply in 3-on-3. They're not the same defensive skills.
No.
You need
speed, you know, and you need skill.
Yeah, and it's a different skill set. Yeah. It's playing defensively in 3-on-3 is not the same thing, and so it doesn't translate, I don't feel, as well. Especially if you win the faceoff and you go on the attack like they did against Winnipeg on Wednesday. It's like they had possession of the puck, they got, but Deneau and Byron stayed out there. They didn't change right away. They actually tried to produce a chance. And it's one thing to win it back to Petrie and then rush off the ice and have two guys jump on. That is a different story, but that's not what happened. What happened was they stayed on. They patiently moved it around. They had lots of time to make a change. And they decided not to do that. They only made the change once they produced the chance, which was a high-end chance. Like, for sure. Jeff Petrie, that was a good chance. But it's if your intent is to get possession of the puck and then attack, well, man, put some attacking players on the ice. You know, I mean, it's really, that's my point, is that there's no reason to do it this way.
And you got guys like Jonathan Drouin or Josh Anderson who are out there who've got that, both the speed and the offensive acumen, you know, to be that sort of player in overtime. The Canadians have guys that fit that profile, at least to start the overtime. But the thing is, if you play on your heels, A, you're going to lose. And B, even if you go all out on attack and it goes against you, well, anyway, that point is up for grabs, and you cannot draw that game. You cannot finish in a draw anyway. So if you're too tentative, you want to protect, you're going to lose. And so that, you know, might as well go all out and try to, because they say we're going to remain patient. We're going to wait until the guys get tired. With a strategy so obvious, I feel also that the other teams are going to quickly adjust to that, because they're going to know when the Canadians expect them to make a move. So I don't know. I agree with you. I mean, I was just playing devil's advocate when I said that, you know, maybe that the counter aspect has to do with the fact that their top end players are not the same. But that's the name of the game at this point. And it's, I won't say that it's killing the Canadian season, but it's definitely a factor. And
it's a huge factor.
Yeah.
It's a huge factor.
Yeah. And you got guys, you know, and Philippe Danault, poor him. I mean, he's being blamed for that because he's put out there, you know, because he's the best face-off guy on the team. But, you know, a good face-off guy in the league will win 54-55% of his face-offs. The difference between a good face-off man and a bad face-off man is certainly not as wide as having Kyle Connor on one end and having Paul Byron on the other. That's a bigger than 10% gap in terms of sheer talent and sheer chance to score a goal. So I think that's where you want to reduce the margin a little bit. But Dano, for many reasons, have been having a target on his back for the whole season. And by the way, we've got a guy, we've got one of our listeners who dropped us a message on our voicemail asking us about Dano and if it was not time to part ways. Let's listen to that.
Hi, guys. This is Andrew Savoy. I'm calling from Kitchener, Ontario. Just wondering when you think the proper time to move on from Philippe Dano. Even would you be willing to package up Dano, Drouin, move some draft picks to a place like Pittsburgh or anywhere that needs draft picks? I mean, Montreal's got too many draft picks and they got a lot of young prospects, so I feel like it's time to move on from and set yourself into a win now mindset.
Well, thanks for the voicemail, Andrew. You know, I don't really get if the Canadians are transferring to a win now mentality, I don't see why they would trade Dano away as a rental. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I mean, the whole thing about the win now part is that you keep your own rentals. If they were not in, if they were, you know, trading away a rental player and essentially weakening your team, it'd be very difficult for the Canadiens, even if they were two separate trades, it'd be very difficult for the Canadiens to find an upgrade on Phil Danault at center at the trade deadline. There's no way the team does not get weaker, because you're not going to have a roster player coming in for a rental. You're going to have a draft pick, maybe a prospect, but no one you're going to plug into your lineup. And so essentially, either you go out and get that player on the rental market, and that player does not exist for all intents and purposes. I don't see a player that's as good as Phil Dano for that role that the Canadiens could get. So really, if the Canadiens are in a win now mentality, which I believe they are, the move is to keep Dano because he's a good player. Listen, he's been maligned for his scoring numbers. Obviously, he gets blamed for this overtime stuff, but he's a good player and he's coming around. I mean, I think he's been playing really well for the last couple of weeks. And so he's important to the team and he's important to their success. So I think cutting bait now is not the move. Will it happen in the offseason? I think there's a decent chance it will. But right now, I don't think this is not the time to do it.
No. I agree. And you see on the nights where Kotkaniemi is off or Suzuki has been in a slump, you know, it's nice to see Dano surging a little bit and becoming, you know, a bit of his old self lately, you know, playing, having his line reunited against Winnipeg. I think it's encouraging. And if he can get back on track and finally find his game down the stretch, it'll help the Canadians tremendously. So it'll be bear watching, but thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Andrew, for submitting your voicemail. If you have a question for us, you can drop that your voicemail at 424-703-3859. That's 424-703-3859. So leave us our messages, your messages, and we'll be happy to answer your questions. Before we get to our guest of the day, Alan Walsh, I wanted to quickly squeeze in our Heritage Minute, because I wanted to point out Thatcher Demko Vancouver Canucks goaltender, Arpin, who's been lights out in the last month. I mean, since the beginning of March, he's been probably the only reason why the Vancouver Canucks have gone on that tear and have come back into somewhat of relevance in the standings. According to Natural Stat Trick, he's been first in the league in that statistic that's called the goal saves above average at 13.3, and the second in the league, Carey Price. So Demko has won seven of his last eight starts, and you know they're in situation. The Canucks right now they're on survival mode, and he's become the indisputable starter. I mean, Braden Holtby has played only one game in that since the beginning of March, but I mean the Canucks are not better. The Canucks are still that team that gave us the most shots in the League 5 on fire in March. They scored 10 of their 22 goals on the power play. So a hot goalie, a hot power play, that's definitely the recipe for a hot streak. I don't know how sustainable is that, but at least it's commendable that they've done that with Elias Pettersson that played only two games. But first and foremost, it's because of Thatcher Demko. I'm curious to see which one of the two games he's going to play against Montreal. But right now, he's their best chance at winning.
Yeah, he is, and it's actually a very similar situation to the Canucks last season, where a lot of the sort of the roster construction warts were masked by Jacob Markstrom, and now Thatcher Demko is doing much the same thing, and you know our colleague Thomas Drantz in Vancouver is imploring the Canucks not to buy into what's going on here. And to sell at the deadline and to continue to bring in assets to improve the team, because it's the second year in a row where the Canucks are just riding hot goaltending to results, which is fine. The goaltender is a member of the team. No one knows that better than people in Montreal who always get accused of carry poop. For years, Carey Price was carrying them to results. And I think you see ultimately that that's not going to get you very far once the postseason hits. But it is a similar dynamic in Vancouver, and so we'll see what happens. Very quickly, my heritage moment is kind of is Calgary and Daryl Sutter coming in, and the strikingly different style of team we see under Daryl Sutter, which I think we're all used to. Like Daryl Sutter, if someone went up to Daryl Sutter and said, "Hey, you know, the game of hockey has really changed a lot in the last 10 years, don't you find? Like a lot more mobility, a lot more skating, a lot faster." I feel like Daryl Sutter would look at that person and be like, nah, game of hockey hasn't changed. It's the same thing, man. You grind it out, you heavy forecheck, you pound it behind their D, you pound their D, and you grind out wins.
Go
and
get them.
Exactly what the go get them. LA Kings big boy hockey has come to Calgary. They have the players to do it. You know, they have guys up front. You know, Bennett maybe I think is going to see a resurgence here under Sutter, unless Treliving decides to trade him. Obviously, they have Lucic. They have guys, bigger guys. You know, Tkachuk goes without saying, who can play that kind of style. And you know, three wins out of the gate under the Daryl Sutter. Obviously, they get blown out by Edmonton on Wednesday, but still, it's going to be a stylistically unique team in the Canadian division. It's really going to be strikingly different. And this is why I kind of think this is not a crazy move for the Flames, because that stylistic difference could actually lead to them being very disruptive in this division. Let's say, I think it's a style that a lot of the teams in the division are going to have a tough time playing against. And it's going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah. Cause it goes against the grain. You're right about that. That's interesting. Well, we'll see. Brad Treliving didn't seem too enthusiastic about making moves at the deadline, so we'll see. But their big move was to change coaches. You know, I wish it had the same effect in Montreal, but so far it hasn't. We'll see how it goes. All right, so guys, stick around. We'll right after the break, we're going to have our guest for today, Agent Alan Walsh, so with us.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So we're back at the Athletic Support, and today our guest is Super Agent Alan Walsh. People might know in Montreal, obviously, Alan has become famous when he defended Yaroslav Halak many years ago. He's also a prominent agent for many stars players in the league, like Marc-André Fleury, among others. Jonathan Drouin here in Montreal. Alan, welcome to the Athletic Support.
Thank you. I've always been a big Athletic supporter.
That's good. That's very good. That's excellent.
It's the name of our fan club. That's actually, we should start a fan club that's the Athletic Supporters. I think with this, man, Alan, thank you. This is fantastic.
I'm member number one.
You'll have the first card.
Right. Absolutely. Always very protective also of your own. So that's good. Listen, Alan, I know you're a busy agent. You've got a lot of things that are on the plate right now. Trade deadline is 3 weeks away, basically. Yeah. I'm curious to know, from your point of view, from your perspective, because this is something that we discussed, Arpin and I, earlier on in the show. We discussed the trade deadline. Do you expect, from your vantage point, a busy trade deadline this year?
I think it's going to be one of the quietest trade deadlines in recent memory. And I think there's a couple of reasons why. Obviously, the cross-border issues are going to put a big damper on the ability of teams to move players between Canada and the U.S. And I also think that just with the way teams are so close to the cap right now, the ability for many teams to add a $5 or $6 million player is just not going to be there. There are certain teams that are built to win or be a top contender this year, but those teams don't, many of those teams in that grouping don't have the flexibility to be able to add pieces. There's a potential to perhaps add a depth piece, an extra forward or an extra defenseman. But I think there are going to be a number of teams who have already made it known that certain players are available. And from my early discussions, because it's still quite early with general managers, there doesn't seem to be the kind of interest or market developing around the prototypical rental type player that we've seen in previous years.
That's interesting. I think that's why. Maybe it won't be as busy, but I think we might see more interesting trades. Like, we might see more hockey trades this year than we do normally because of the whole money in, money out factor, and all the limitations that you mentioned. Maybe we won't get as many deals, but I think the deals we do get maybe will be more traditional trades, like the trades that we're used to seeing in the past. I don't know how much talk there is of making those. Are more complicated to make, obviously, because you're giving up something to get something. But it seems to me that, but one other complication I wanted to ask you about, and I don't know if this applies for your clients, but we are hearing that, you know, there is a possibility that players with limited no trade clause, especially the ones playing in the United States and especially Americans playing in the United States, but generally players on US teams, that they've put Canadian teams on their no trade list because of the quarantine issue this year. Can you give any sense if there's any truth to that, or to what extent that might be true?
I don't think that I have a number of clients with limited no trade clauses, and most of the clauses are written so that the trade list is due on or before July 1 each year. And in the transition rules, that date was modified because of the pandemic. But there was a date in September where if you had submitted a list prior to July 1, the player had the ability to revise his list if he liked up until a certain date in September. And in a few situations, we updated our list. I've never discussed with a player, any client, hey, we have to put Canadian teams on the list because you don't want to go to Canada now. There's a whole host of reasons why certain teams would end up on a list or not. I think some of those reasons would actually surprise people. It could be strictly who the coach is. It could be who some of the players on the team right now are. It could be, players sit back and they look, who am I going to play with? Who are my teammates going to be?
Okay, you mean it that way, not like, oh, I really hate that guy. I don't want to go play on a team with him.
No, it's not that I don't like that guy. It's going to be, well, where am I going to fit in to that team if I were to ever there in that situation? And coming towards the trade deadline, some players are projecting who they expect to be some of the better teams in the league. And who might not be some of the better teams in the league. And they would actually think of things like, you know, I don't want to be a salary dump casualty and go to these teams that have a lot of cap space that are not going to contend. So there's so many different factors that go into it. I've never had one player say to me, let's just put our list together so that we don't have to jump the border.
If we just take a step back and look at the season as a whole, I mean, the NHL had a bit of a bumpy start in certain markets like Dallas or New Jersey and Buffalo because of COVID-19. What do you make of this season, of how it's been handled so far? And in addition to that, I don't know what your conversations have been with your clients, but is there something about the strain of a team bubble on the players' mental health? How's it been for them?
Well, look at where we are right now. There was a time earlier in the season when we had approximately 30 players on the COVID list, on the daily list. And it was certain teams were being completely shut down. I had some conversations with players, executives, GMs, where we were all in fear of perhaps the NHL approaching a pause. And now we have three or four players on the list league-wide. So it's been interesting as a reflection of society, how in many parts of the United States, things are opening up and the COVID positivity rate is dropping exponentially week to week to week. We've seen similar trends in professional sports in North America from NBA, MLB, NCAA, March Madness, NHL, that it all seems to be trending in the right direction. And every league has a different a set of protocols on what you can do or not do. The NHL's protocols for players is quite strict. I've had players, clients come through LA, and I have not had the ability to sit with them, even wearing masks, being socially distanced and respecting the protocols, because the players are not allowed to meet with people on the road. They're not even allowed to have a teammate in their own hotel room on the road. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question with regard to mental health, I think it's a huge issue. And there are a number of players struggling with issues of isolation, loneliness, some depression, anxiety. When you go on the road for 10 or 12 days, and it's kind of a joke amongst players, well, I guess I'll go to my room now because there's nothing else I can do. You can't go to a restaurant. Right. You can't go to a shopping mall. You can't go do the things you would normally do on the road to kill time, relax your brain, get out a little bit, see people, even just going out and people watching. There's so many limitations on what you can do. I had a player say to me, you know what I'd like to do, Alan? I just want to be out on a golf course right now. I want to take my shoes off and I want to rub my toes in the grass. I mean, there's that kind of hunger to just be out of the confining space of the hotel. And the isolation is a huge issue. And I've had players call me on the road midway through a road trip and say, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. I don't know how I'm going to go another 5-6 days like this. So it's a big issue.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, I was texting with a player who kind of said, you know, how this was preferable to the bubble. Even though I think a lot of players think it's not preferable to the bubble, because you had a little bit more social interaction in the bubble, in the playoff bubbles, I mean, than they do now. But then that same player, when I texted him back, I was like, hey, what do you do at night? He's like, well, basically, I stare at the walls. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that doesn't sound very good at all. You know, I mean, it's really, but when you mentioned the positivity rates and everything in the United States, the context in the United States being different to Canada, do you have any clients who have been vaccinated?
To your
knowledge?
I have a few clients that have been vaccinated. Most have not.
Right. And, you know, obviously in Canada, we're far behind the US in that regard. And I'm not suggesting that your clients jumped a line of any kind, but do you think, at what point does a conversation have to be held between the PA and the NHL as to what vaccinated players are allowed to do versus non-vaccinated players?
I think there's a conversation that needs to happen. There may be discussions like that are ongoing right now. I think that when you look at that whole issue, it's becoming much more ripe in the sense that I think with, you know, for example, in California, it's now opened up, vaccination has opened up for people between the ages of 16 and 65 with any enumerated underlying condition. And many people in LA, I think we're up to 38 to 40% of LA County has now been vaccinated with at least one dose. And I think that as players move towards being vaccinated on a more league-wide basis and more players are carrying, you know, immunities, I think there's going to naturally be some reflection of that in a revision to the protocols at some point.
But obviously at this point, the pandemic has already done a lot of significant damage on the economics of hockey. And we had Gary Bettman the other day announcing that that basically there would be a flat cap for the next 4 years. I mean, I think every team had anticipated that it would happen for 2 years, maybe three, but now what do you see as the biggest impact of that flat cap going on? And because obviously, I mean, general managers will have their hands handcuffed, you know, and I think that there was a projection when high salaries like the ones to Carey Price or to Jack Eichel or no matter what, I mean, those big salaries, eventually they would take less and less of a percentage inside a team's payroll. So now it's not going to be the case. But what do you identify as probably the biggest consequence?
Well, I think that I disagree with Gary Bettman. It's a big shocker to all of you. I think we're probably going to be 5 years with a flat cap. And perhaps even the full 6 years based on where we're going to be this year and where we might be. All of the projections that were done in looking at NHL revenues going forward all contemplated a full and robust HRR number at or above $4.8 billion for the 21-22 season. And Right. And we don't know today whether the Canadian buildings and the NHL is still very much a gate-driven league, if the Canadian buildings will all be able to hold 18,000 plus come October. We might get there. We might not. If we don't, that will take a huge hit out of that HRR number, which will lead to a further increase of the escrow debt, which will carry over, I think, to a year five or potentially a year six of the CBA, with the cap remaining fairly flat. There might be a time where the NHL and the NHLPA agree mutually to increase the upper limit by $1 million or $2 million to give teams some breathing room. That will also prolong the time that the escrow debt gets paid off. Mm-hmm. But that could happen. But even if you increased the escrow debt by, let's say, the upper limit by $2 million, is that really going to make a huge difference in the universe of the marketplace? I don't think so. So I think as teams are looking at their situation right now, what are we going to see? We're going to see more buyouts. We're going to see more buyouts every summer, probably more than we've ever seen before. We're going to see,
right,
we're going to see teams looking to shed contracts of really good players. And we saw a little bit of that in the off season, where some really good players with big numbers on their contracts were available and being shopped, and there weren't many takers. I think we're going to see a lot of movement around the league and distribution of money around the league to reflect the fact the cap is going to remain flat for a number of years.
How does that impact your ability to negotiate contracts for your clients? Because it's obvious, everything you said is true, and I think it's not disputed. Obviously, you're saying it as an agent, so you understand the reality of the business right now. But you also have an obligation to your client to get him the best contract possible. Do you see a shift to shorter term contracts, and that being the client wanting a shorter term contract as opposed to the teams wanting a shorter term contract, in the sense that, in the hope that maybe the league's finances can recover a little quicker than maybe we anticipated?
One of the big reasons I've always disliked a salary cap system so much is that it really does pit players versus players on the same team.
Yes,
and in the league, absolutely. There's only so many dollars available in the pie, and everybody is vying for their share of those dollars. And you've got young players versus older players. You've got established players versus younger players, guys coming off entry level who are elite guys already in the league looking for big money. And it causes great dissension inherent within the system. And that's one of the reasons leagues like the NHL love the salary cap system so much, because you're never going to find unity amongst a group of now 800 players plus, when everybody is vying against the other player, the other member of your union, for your share of that pie. So it's a huge issue. When you look at the term, if I'm sitting with clients and we are fairly confident that within 2 or 3 years, the escrow debt will be retired and the upper limit will start jumping to reflect $600 million plus TV deal in the US, I would definitely be looking towards shorter term deal for certain players to take advantage of that. But I've sat and I've looked at the numbers and I've played with the numbers, And I've been doing this since 2005. It's part of my job. I don't see any way possible we're going to be looking at a retired escrow debt before 4 years in a best case scenario, maybe in a perfect case scenario, but more likely 5 or even 6 years. So the attractiveness of going 3 years to come into the marketplace with a better opportunity for certain players doesn't exist. And one more factor is, remember, the escrow cap is going down throughout the life of this deal. And in years 4, 5, and 6 of this deal, escrow is capped at 6%. So if you...
Which means that debt will just last longer, right?
Well, sure. It could. It definitely could. But yeah, from a player's perspective, if they can lock in a number they're happy with, and instead of paying 20% escrow, which is what they're paying right now, they can be guaranteed to pay no more than 6%. There is an attractiveness in going 6 years and taking advantage of those 3 years of relatively low escrow.
Well, luckily, I mean, most of your all your bigger clients, whether it's Pacioretty or Huberdeau, guys like that, are signed beyond this year. It's also the case for Jonathan Drouin in Montreal. Now, I wanted to ask you about Joe. What do you think the coaching change has had? What impact has it had on his season so far?
Well, it's still fairly fresh. I think Joe this season has had a very strong season overall from the beginning of the season, and clearly, there is a very close relationship that exists between Joe and Dominique Ducharme. It's a relationship born out of respect and also born out of winning together. They won Quebec League championships together. They won a Memorial Cup together. And there is a bond that exists that gets created when you win, when you go through the wars together. And they have that. And I think Dom can speak to Joe different than anybody else based on that relationship. But Dom is a very tough coach as well. And I'll tell you a story. I've been working with Joe since he was just turned 17. And when he was playing in Halifax, I went up to Halifax one weekend to see him play 2 games. And after the game, Joe and I visited for a little while. And he said to me, "Did you hear what happened Wednesday night?" And I said, "No." He said, "Yeah." He said, "A couple of times this season, I've come back to the bench and I've been frustrated and I've slammed the door and sat down on the bench. And I did it last week." And Dom walked over to me and said, "Hey, Joe, don't do that again." He says, "And I was frustrated Wednesday night, came back to the bench, slammed the door." He goes, "All of a sudden, Dom grabbed my stick and broke it across his knee and threw the 2 pieces down on the ground and told the trainer, don't give him another stick." He says, "So I sat on the bench." He goes, "It was the second period. I sat on the bench for about 9 minutes with no stick. And the period was up. And I looked back at Dom and he was glaring at me. And I just jumped on the ice and made the skate across the ice to the dressing room with no stick. And, we're ready to go for the third period." And I go up to Dom and I said, "Dom, can I get my stick?" And Dom says, "Oh, you can't play without a stick, eh?" And I said, "No, I need a stick." He goes, "No, you're done for the night." He says, "So I skated across the ice again." He goes, "And sat on the bench for the entire third period with no stick." And he goes, "And that,
that's fantastic."
And he said, and Joe said, "That was the last time I slammed the door."
Yeah, Exactly. Yeah. Point received, coach. I got the point finally. Yeah.
But
that's hilarious. Well, yeah, I think Joe has mentioned the level of accountability he has with Dom. It's not a free ride. I mean, I think a lot of people assume because they have a past relationship that Joe's going to get a free pass. And it's really, I think it's the opposite, really. It's that now Dom's been empowered as the head coach to really, and Joe's mentioned it numerous times, when he has a detail issue on a shift, he hears about it as soon as he gets back to the bench. Like it is immediate feedback. And I think that's going to help Joe. It's going to help all the players. But I mean, really, I think Joe sometimes has a tendency to, bad habits can creep into his game from time to time. And I think he's cognizant of that. And having Dom, he's recognized that Dom keeps that in check and it does it like immediately.
I think that because of the history that they have, I think it's very accurate to say Dom could be harder on Joe than almost any other coach in the league can be. And it will be received in a positive way. Joe doesn't mind somebody pushing him. He likes it. And Dom knows exactly what buttons to push and when. And I think that one of the main jobs of a coach in the NHL is to get the most out of his players. And I think Dom has a history of doing that on the teams that he's coached. But talking about just the personal relationship between Joe and Dom, I think Dom can get the best out of Joe as well.
But is it fair to say that considering who's behind the bench, the relationship he's got with Dom, considering, you know, he's surrounded by a better group of players than before, at least in Montreal, that Joe's at a point in his career where if he wants to take it to another level, A, now the onus is entirely on him, and B, the situation has never been better for him to accomplish that. Would you say that?
Yeah, I don't like making or searching for excuses. I think players have to be responsible for their game. And if you have a situation where you don't like who you're playing with, or if you don't like the ice time that you have, you address it, you deal with it, you go in and talk to people. Sometimes your agent can make a phone call to talk to people, but I don't like sitting back with players and saying, well, this situation isn't very good for you. And that's a reason why you're not playing the way you can play. I like to eliminate excuses and really drive accountability for players, for clients, and talk honestly. You know, in my interpersonal relationships with my clients, I'm not a cheerleader. Some guys need to be pushed. Some guys need to be challenged. Players don't want the people closest to them just to tell them how good they're playing. If an agent is that's what you're doing, you're really not of much use, really, in that right. regard. And
you're enabling something at that point.
Exactly.
If you're lying to your client, I mean.
Exactly. And if you ever had an opportunity to take some clients of mine aside and have a very open and frank conversation, I think they would share that they get none of that from me. Yes, I use social media to promote accomplishments of my players, but that's totally separate from the relationship I have with guys on a one-on-one basis. And not just with players, but with their whole families. You know, they're in many situations, I'm very close with the player's longtime girlfriend or wife, where we've known each other and worked together for many years. And issues that have come up, any issue that impacts the player also by the essence of the family dynamic impact the entire family as well, right? So you're also mm-hmm. interacting with everybody right. throughout the family unit. And I think it's incumbent upon an agent to be direct and honest. I have no problems saying to a player, you know, we're in trouble here. Like, let's call it, uh-huh. let's call it what it is. We're in trouble. Now let's look at what our options are. And this might be plan A, and this might be plan B, and this may be plan C. And we'll discuss it and go through the different options. There may be a last resort option after every other option has been tried and there is nothing else left to do except shake things up. And hopefully it's a last resort and you don't have to go there often. But my obligation, I am 100% committed to my clients and helping them in many different ways. I can't play for them. I'm not a hockey coach. I'm not a skill coach. I'm not a power skating coach. I don't tell players how to play. You should have passed instead of shoot. You need to shoot instead of pass. That's not my role. I've never gone there. Mm-hmm. I'm never going there. But on the business side, as it bleeds into the ability for players to maximize their performance, whether there's a distraction, whether there is something standing in their way, we're in it together to get the player to maximize his full potential.
Okay, well, that actually leads perfectly into what will be our last question here, Alan, because you know we've kept you for long enough here. But there's you have two more clients in the Canadiens organization. I feel they're in extremely different circumstances right now, and it goes back to our question about mental health and everything that you just said. Michael Frolik, who, if you watch practice, and I know most of the fans don't get to, but I mean, this guy acts like he's some sort of rookie trying to impress the team with his work ethic and staying late. You know, Alexander Romanov has been notorious for a guy who you literally have to drag off the ice, but the second to last guy off the ice every practice is your client, Michael Frolik, has not had a sniff at a game yet. And on the other end, in Laval, you have Jan Michak, who is getting an opportunity that he otherwise might not have gotten right now, and playing really well for the Rocket and getting, you know, getting his feet wet in professional hockey in North America. Could you maybe contrast how you're dealing with those two clients right now? Because they're in very different headspaces, they're in very different circumstances. And as an agent, based on everything you just said, that's got to be a challenge.
Arpin, literally every day is a challenge right now.
Yes, I could understand that. And I know that you have, you know, you must have, if you had like a complaint box, a virtual complaint box in your email, like it would be overflowing, I would imagine, every day with all the clients coming at you, I guess. I'm guessing.
Here's what I would say. You know, I have approximately 40 players in the NHL, and literally at a single point in time, just by the odds, there seems to always be at least one player out of the entire group that is in some sort of a mini crisis at one time. And you're just, I've told people in the past, geez, I don't even feel like an agent anymore. I feel like a fireman. I'm just walking around with this giant fire hose on my shoulder, putting out fires left and right. And then you get that situation settled down, and then another one crops up, and you bounce around just putting out fires. And that's what the last 2 years has felt like in many respects. But with regard to Michael Frolik, you know, I've been working with Michael since he was 16, and he's like part of my family, and his family are part of my family. So you have to take that aspect of the relationship and separate that out a bit and be there as an agent to do your job. And with Michael, you know, last year, the Canadians had a lot of injuries and went through and lots of players got an opportunity to play. And I think with the schedule, the way it's structured this year, that certainly was an expectation that there would be a lot of injuries. Michael would get an opportunity earlier in the season to get his foot in the door by playing. And because he's so hardworking, keeps himself in such amazing shape, gets out there, plays well, capture a regular spot in the roster. Once he goes in, once Michael Frolik gets an opportunity to play, I would predict he doesn't come out, right? He'll take that right. opportunity and run with it. And I don't know when that opportunity is going to arise.
But where's his head at? Because when we talked about the mental health stuff before, I think about him a fair amount because he's dealing with all the other challenges that all the other players are. Except he doesn't get to play. Like, he doesn't have that release that the other players do, that motivation, I guess, to go through it. Like, how is he handling things right now?
He's managing. It's not easy. It's certainly there's some adversity that's been thrown his way. But he loves the game. He loves to be around the guys. He's always, you know, he has a long history of training and living in Montreal every summer since he was 17. And so he's comfortable and familiar with the city and he's still waiting for his opportunity. I would be lying if I said it was easy. It's not. And he has a burning desire to get in the lineup, but he's managing. He's doing what he needs to do to always show the coaches he's a pro. And he wants to be respected as a pro. And in all my conversations with Montreal, the first thing they say when Michael's name is up in a discussion is, Alan, he's such a pro. He's such a good pro. He's working so hard every day. They know. They see the same thing you see. And they know how hard he's working. They know the kind of shape he's in. For 6 years in a row in Calgary, he won the award each successive year for the most fit player in training camp after the fitness testing. He is a physical specimen. And when he gets his chance, I believe he'll make the most of it. When it comes to Jan Mišák, here he is at 18, playing in the American League, scoring some nice goals, just scored a highlight reel goal last week. Stealing the puck at center ice and charging down the ice and scoring a beauty. He did. I think that he's getting an experience that is opening up a lot of people's eyes around the league for players similarly situated like him. It's I've advocated for this for years now. There needs to be a carve out in the NHL-CHL agreement that will allow highly drafted players in each organization to play in the American League as opposed to being returned to junior at 18 or 19 years of age if they can play. And I don't want to see 4 or 5 18, 19-year-olds on each American League roster. But there needs to be a carve out. There's no question about it. There are players whose development is being stunted because they are literally too good for the Canadian Hockey League. They are not yet good enough to play in the NHL, and the American League is the perfect league for them at 18 or 19. It's where they should be. And every team should have the ability to have, you know, at least one player playing through this carve out at any one time, whether you want to limit it to first round picks, whether you want to limit it to one player every 2 years, you know, no one's looking to raid the CHL of their best players, but The CHL says they're the number one development league in the world, and it's all about development. Well, if in the players' best interest, they're better off playing in the American League, why should they be stopped because the CHL is demanding some proprietary interest in the player and bringing him back to junior against his best interests?
Right. I mean, the Canadians and, you know, numerous teams have had this situation, but the Canadians had Caden Gooley, their first round pick, playing in Laval. They were ecstatic. Joel Bouchard couldn't stop saying enough good things about him. They were really happy to be able to work with him. And then as soon as the WHL got up and running, he was gone. And, you know, obviously we saw these situations, and hopefully what you just described actually comes to pass, because I do think an exception needs to be made. There's an exceptional, you know, it's ironic. The CHL has exceptional player status, but you can't give a CHL player exceptional player status, allowing him to play in the AHL. You know, it seems there's some give and take there, but I agree with you 100%. It's a ridiculous rule and definitely needs to be changed. Listen, Alan, we're going to thank you. This was fantastic. We went a little bit over time here, but I think our listeners are going to appreciate it. Hope you're able to navigate the rest of this season well. So I hope it's smooth sailing. I know that your clients have to have a lot of issues that you have to, you know, these fires that you have to put out, as you described. But thanks so much for taking a little bit of time and speaking to us. Really appreciate it.
It's a privilege being with you guys, and I've enjoyed our conversation.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Alan.
You got it.
Well, that was interesting. Alan's always interesting to talk to. I love, it's one of the really the high, other than getting to visit LA, one of the bonuses of getting to visit LA is that you always come across Alan and you always get to have a conversation. Back when we actually went places, and back when we actually were allowed to have face-to-face conversations, he's one of the favorite guys to run into at the practice facility, because he's always there to see Joe or any other client he might have on the Canadians. And it's always great running into him, because he's frank. He's not, the reason why he's so refreshing to talk to is that he's, you know, there's not much he's not willing to talk about.
No, and he fights for his players. I mean, I respect that. I know that he might rub some people the wrong way, or that he might sound too abrasive or whatnot. But every time that there's a heated situation, he's the one taking the heat instead of his client.
Thanks to Alan for coming on. We're going to wrap it up. We went really long this week, but I think it was worth it with all the stuff happening and with Alan being as interesting as he was. But I just want to remind our listeners that it is March. And March, when I was in university, basically for the first two rounds of the NCAA tournament, I did not go to class.
Really?
I don't want to advocate not going to class, but the first Thursday and the first Friday of the NCAA tournament are days that I spent ordering food, not leaving my couch, and watching 12 consecutive hours of college basketball for those 2 days. So 24 hours combined. I was a junkie. If you are like me, you know, the Athletics College Basketball crew has The Ding You, presented by BetMGM. They cover all the action on the court, sports book, grabbing insight from the Athletics College Basketball writers, and picking their brains of BetMGM's top bookmakers to help you with any bets you want to place on games and just your enjoyment of the tournament. So join us. Join these guys, I should say, because I'm not involved, because I wouldn't know what to say. But join these guys for their second round discussion show Sunday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Daily Ding feed and streaming on the Athletics YouTube channel. Check that out.